triple blessings to you all. Welcome back to episode 7 of Discuss Foundation. This week, my name's Nick, as always. This is my co-host, Brian. This week, we are discussing episode 7 of season 1 of Foundation, titled...
Death and the Maiden.
I know, Death and the Maiden. And who's the director for this one?
This is going to be directed by Jennifer Fong, and it is written by Marcus Gardley.
All right, fantastic, guys. As always, for the podcast today, what we're going to be doing is going through our general feelings on the podcast initially. Then we're going to go ahead and hop into a recap or a breakdown, kind of more scene by scene, a little more of our specific feelings on each scene in the episode. And then finally, we're going to give our predictions for what we think is going to happen in the next one. Before we hop into this and I kick it over to Brian for his feelings, I do want to put a quick disclaimer in here, which is that me and Brian have not read Isaac Asimov's book series. So we are coming at this from two guys that stumbled upon the show and really like it and kind of sci-fi fans. But we don't know about the book and all the connections and stuff and how it differs from the show. So just keep that in mind and bear with us with that. If you guys want something more dense along those lines, there are other podcasts that kind of tackle that source material, such as Apple's. I think there's a Stars End podcast that does that as well, that I've been following. So you guys can definitely check that out if you're looking for something more book heavy along the lines of this kind of discussion. But with all that being said, Brian, what did you think of this episode? I know, just a little preface for everybody too. Our last episode was our least favorite of the season. So what did you think of this one, and how does it compare to last episode?
I generally like this one a whole lot better in regards to how it structured the story, how it moved the plot, the visuals. We got back to a lot of the things that we really did enjoy were great visuals, great surroundings, great settings with everything being involved in the story. So that was really cool. We got to see another planet, which was the Holy Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the Maiden. Holy Moon. Yeah, the Maiden.
Yeah, the Maiden. So it's the Maiden. So we got to see that. And overall, the story flowed very well. The narratives were really good. The action sequences were massively huge improvement. So yeah, generally liked it a whole lot better than the previous episode.
Awesome. I generally agree with you too. Like I like this a lot more than the last one. What I'm finding is that the show does really well when it's introducing stuff and doing setup for the world and stuff. So it didn't really have a lot of conclusions drawn for this one. So I still worry about that for future episodes, but I tend to enjoy the show a lot more when we're getting introduced to new characters, new cultures, new worlds, all that kind of stuff. Just like the sci-fi nerd in me just kind of geeks out over that stuff. So I really like the going to the Maiden and seeing that entire thing and the culture and all that kind of world building that brings up. And I also just really, I think personally, I am clicking a lot more with the Cleon storyline than I am with the Salvor or Gale storyline specifically. Yeah. I think I'm just having a lot more fun, and I find that dynamic more engaging between dawn, dusk, and day and all that kind of stuff. So because this was more heavy in that area, I think I enjoyed it a lot more as well. But let's go ahead and kick into the episode here. I first want to start off here because I initially, when we first did our recap of the first three episodes, we talked about the intro sequence with Bear McCreary's score and stuff like that. And I had said how I wasn't really feeling the music as much just because there wasn't a hook to it. I'm kind of warming to it. I like I kind of like the score. I find myself kind of humming it when it comes on now. And and the score specifically in this episode, I think, was fantastic. And we can talk about that later on in the episode, because I think there were a couple of musical flourishes in here that I thought were really, really, really well done. I think I'm kind of changing my mind regarding the intro sequence. I think it's obviously we said it looked beautiful, but I think the music's kind of growing on me too. And I said that might happen when we first watched it. I said, hey, as it goes on, maybe this is something that I start to kind of vibe with. And that's definitely occurring.
That's good to hear that the music that you're finally turn around on the music. So that's good.
Yeah. I never disliked it, but I'm starting to see kind of the appeal of that intro song. So the episode starts off, we are on a jump ship. We are on the Imperial jump ship, and it's Cleon is traveling. He's awoken by the spacers.
Brother
Day. Traveling through light. He immediately kind of goes in and speaks to Eto Demerzel, the robot assistant or the advisor, I guess, of the Cleons. And she's getting herself ready in her chambers, and they have kind of a discussion about the fact that she can stay awake through jump drive speeds. And she says, you know, he asks her like what it's like, and she says something along the lines of, if I could tell you, you wouldn't have to sleep through it. It's too the human mind can't handle the discontinuity apparently that that comes with that. I found that section pretty interesting because I kind of highlights how rare what Gale did earlier in the season was.
Yes, it did.
Where apparently she was able to kind of like open her eyes and kind of not lose her mind or comprehend what. So it kind of alludes to how powerful mentally and stuff Gale is, and how her brain is so different than everyone else's. The fact that she was kind of able to be awake during that.
Yeah, that it was really unique that they kind of had to harken back to like, yes, Gale did survive it because she was able to understand it. And this kind of like helped confirm us. That was good that they're falling mm-hmm. back on some of their plot points.
Right. And it makes sense that Gale is so kind of versed in ordinal analysis and stuff, too, because apparently if you're able to deconstruct and understand these really, really kind of obscure scientific or mathematical equations and topics, it would make sense that maybe that applies to other stuff as well. So
yeah,
she would be able to kind of fathom the discontinuity of space bending. Is that what it's called? I think they call it like space folding. Sorry, folding space.
Okay. Yeah. The Event Horizon, the movie Event Horizon, was you fold space, but they were able to fold space where in between of the two connections, you went through a black hole.
Right.
So they found the one connecting and the other connecting, and you kind of just pass the black hole to get to the opposite side.
Right. Which is really interesting space travel. I don't think I had seen, I mean, I'm sure that they've done it in plenty of sci-fi movies, something along those lines, but I hadn't seen it kind of done in this way where like the ship creates a black hole and then yeah. they use that to kind of bend space and stuff. So they go and talk to Demerzel,
yep.
and they start recapping Luminism and talking about how Luminism is like 15,000 years old and it predates yeah. the Imperial Dynasty, which is why it kind of has more, I think they're setting up that Luminism may have a little more respect among the people than
yeah.
The dynasty, something along those lines as well. What did you think about the scene where he's speaking to Demerzel and they're going through the entire Luminism history and all that kind of stuff?
It was really unique because it helped set the history of it. And this was the first time that it was kind of implied that the Emperor had to be taught somehow, like on all his knowledge, that he wasn't this all knowing, all knowledgeable person. And this helps set the stage of like, okay, this is how he gains his diplomacy. This is how he gains his stuff. We saw it in episode 2, I believe, with Brother Day, where he kind of talked a little bit, but this was like the first time we got to see that it wasn't just with one, it was with every single
yeah.
of the emperors that she does this with.
Right. She's essentially like an in-home tutor. Yeah. She carries a lot of hats for this family. Like she does a lot yeah. of different stuff for them. There was two big plot points that came up that I wanted to talk about regarding that scene, which is when she discusses Luminism. I saw a lot of parallels with Luminism and the Christian Trinity, where it talks yeah. about like these different, their different moons, and because they were broken up into three, but they long to be unified together as one
yep.
and stuff. I saw a lot of Holy Trinity references, but more interestingly, I saw a lot of parallels with that and the Cleon Dynasty, where they're three separate entities.
Yeah.
That maybe they should kind of feel compelled to be one, but they're like split among three different life cycles and stuff. So I also saw parallels with that. So I thought that was really cool how they kind of drew threads in between those three things.
Well, the number three has a lot of semblances in a lot of religion, not just like with Christian culture, but if I'm not mistaken, also Judeo culture as well. So it's like three is an important number, mm-hmm. The Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Things like that. So it's really unique that they're incorporating that type of ideology into different aspects of the show, not just the religious aspect, but the Cleon aspects, the Emperor yeah. aspects that they're, like I said, there's a mirror and a thread that it kind of connects them, where one sees themselves as the ultimate ruler and the other one sees themselves as the understanding the ultimate ruler, like understanding God. So it's really
yeah.
unique. The difference is that one person thinks that they're God and the other people believe in a God and mm-hmm. that's not him.
Exactly. And it also feeds into the theme that I think is probably one of the strongest things of the show, which is this idea of faith and science being more related and more connected than one would think. I think when a lot of people think of those on the face value, they think of science and religion as different ends of a spectrum.
Yeah.
And I think this show is kind of trying to make the case that they are... they're a lot closer than you would think. So Cleon represents a very scientific genetic cloning kind of version of this Trinity and stuff yeah. along those lines. And then Luminism is talking about this very spiritual, like unifying of a Holy Trinity and being separated between these things. It kind of feeds into that thematic element of like science and faith being more, yeah. more blurry, the distinction well, between them.
I don't know if it's the theory or like the ideas, but what it is, it's in science, you think it was made by God until you could figure out how it was made. Mm-hmm. And that's how we've evolved, where we'll see a rainbow. We're like, oh my God, God made the rainbow. This is a great sign. And then you find out there's this water moistures reflecting into the sunlight.
Right.
And that's how you get the rainbow. But we've always evolved that whenever we can't explain something, we say that it's God mm-hmm. until we can figure out how it's done.
Right.
So it's kind of like a unique perspective that they still have that here in the show, that Cleon thinks that he's God because he's just forever living. He'll never die.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, how do you explain it? Well, no, he's God because he'll never explain how he did it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a unique parallel of how God plays into science and science plays into God and mm-hmm. believing into it. That's why, and it's a weird statistic, but there's a lot of scientists who are heavily involved in religion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it goes down to a lot of it is science generally explains how, but religion tries to answer why, or the more kind of like why questions of it. And I think a lot of it is kind of commenting on that in the show. It's commenting on that they may be able to explain like how certain things happen, but there's like the religious aspect is always going to think that they like God is using those as a means to make something happen. You know what I mean? Like God yeah. is utilizing those scientific concepts to make something occur or whatever. So yeah, I just like the, I think that's a very broad and theme that probably connects with a lot of people. And I like that the show is kind of continually going back to that. The other thing I did want to talk about in the scene that was a really important piece of information, in my opinion, was that Edo Demerzel is a Luminist. Like she is of that faith.
Yeah,
which I thought was very kind of surprising to me, because I can't think of other depictions of androids that were religious. I was racking my brain trying to think of like other depictions of like robots or androids in sci-fi that were like
Futurama, Bender.
Oh, Bender. I didn't watch Futurama, so.
Well, there's a robot devil and all this stuff, and there's robot God and everything.
But in the more kind of high sci-fi stuff.
Oh, like, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
In the more pretentious sci-fi area, I guess. I hadn't seen that trait come up, and it brought up a lot of questions of like, was she programmed to like believe in Luminism, or is this something that devolved? Or are they making a commentary that she's of free will for the most part and all this stuff? But I think, and we'll talk about this by the end of the episode, because I think there's a statement made regarding that towards the end of the episode that I think is really interesting. But I thought that was really interesting information to bestow, is that Edo Demerzel, their robotic android advisor, is a devout Luminist. I thought that was interesting.
Before we move on to like the next scene, because I want to move on to the next one.
Yeah.
When the first time like he's talking to her, she's putting on like, she's fixing herself, but the way that she does it, it's almost as if she's putting on makeup. Mm-hmm. And it was very unique perspective, because like that's the proper way to put on certain types of blushes and where she was doing. So it's a nice take that she's fixing herself, mimicking the things of makeup. Like you're using it as a brush, very feminine.
Right.
Compared to very like, just fix it and be on your way.
Absolutely. It's like she's applying her face, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was a really... And it was a beautiful shot. That's why like I was like, make notes of brush with the
And the mirrors and the way they were using her reflection and stuff in that scene was really cool too. Again, I think we don't want to keep harking on it necessarily on the podcast, but this episode as well looked fucking beautiful. It looked very like, it looked amazing. So a lot of the visuals in this were great. So on the next scene is where they essentially leave the ship and they are welcomed. Usually there's a lot of pageantry and a big event when Cleon, especially, this is, you know, keep in mind, this is the first time that the young prime Cleon has ever left Trantor. So this is kind of a really big deal in 400 years. So he's expecting this kind of huge rollout of love and support. And he just gets the heretic that he is trying to stop from becoming Proxima, Zephyr Halima, I think is her name.
Yep, Zephyr
and she, Halima. She's the one that meets him on the bridge, I guess, or wherever they park there. So there's a really tense and cool kind of standoff between her and a really cool character introduction to her, where she's kind of standing toe to toe with Cleon. And what did you think of that scene and that performance and stuff in this new character?
I like the scene because you expect the Emperor, the Grand Emperor, to have this massive fanfare, to have this massive gala, and you're welcome with the one person that's trying to prevent you from spreading your sphere of influence,
mm-hmm.
go toe-to-toe with you, not afraid to tell you the truth, not afraid to be like, I'll call you out. And yeah. Here's our customs, and you don't trust anyone
mm-hmm.
that's not within your realm, because you think about it, if she were to kill him, what does she get out of it? Because there's still Brother Dawn, mm-hmm. Brother Dusk,
right.
And it'll set them all back. So what she's done, and they mention it, like, we should have drank him from that water cup. We screwed up.
Yeah.
We gave her power. Right. And it was a great scene. It was an amazingly scene, because you see, like, the acting, like, Lee Pace is phenomenal in his portion of here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where he nails it. Because you just see the interaction right after, goes, we screwed up. And they're like, yep, you screwed up.
Yeah, no, I agree. And they allude to it kind of in Gail's beginning speech in the episode, yeah. where she says that she had never met a person that was so confident and never had any doubt until he met Herod Selden. And you're starting to see that doubt manifest in these scenes where he's, like you said, he should have known that there's no way she would poison him in that because they saw what had happened to Anacreon and Thespis when they crossed the Empire. So there's nothing stopping from that entire world from exploding if something like that happened. So
yeah, exactly.
But again, you're starting to see that doubt creep into both he and Demerzel regarding the idea that the Empire might fall has caused them to kind of go on the back heels. You know, they're starting to back up and are a little more wary of stuff like that. I thought the interaction between her and Cleon was really good. It reminded me of like a really good political chess match that you would see in other shows, kind of more geared towards politics specifically, because she had this like intense, like really effective passive aggressiveness, you know, where it's like, oh, go ahead.
This is highbrow sci-fi, so I'm hoping you saw this.
Mm-hmm.
Battlestar Galactica. It had a lot of these type of scenes where it was just the president and the admiral, and they're having a friendly banter, but deep down you know that there are jabs, there are jabs, they're getting underneath each other's skin to try to get the upper hand on who's right and who's wrong. So it felt very much intimate, Battlestar Galactica style, where and then when you throw in the silence, it's like, ooh, okay.
Yeah. It's I've seen similar stuff in The Expanse too, and Battlestar Galactica. The Expanse has kind of these political chess matches too. But it's like you said, it's essentially like they're talking to each other super polite, but it's dripping in this like combative subtext that's like, you know, you could just feel it. So you could feel that even though she says that it's because she wants to take a more somber tone because the Proxima has died, and that's why there's no pageantry. Yeah. You can tell that it was really done to undercut his need for that affirmation from people.
Yeah,
so it was kind of done to undercut that as well. And then offering him the Dreek, like you said, was such an alpha move, because it's like, if they say yes, they're worried that she's going to kill him. So by saying no, she's like, oh, there's some doubt here. He's kind of worried. He's worried about me, you know, and you can kind of sense that immediately.
He views me as an enemy.
Yeah, and we should really quickly note too that Demerzel also said she wanted to stay on the ship because she was worried that her faith, and they know that she's... So apparently it's well known in the galaxy that the advisor to Cleon is a Luminist, because she said that her role as a member of the faith may be used to work against him, and he insisted that she come with him. So I thought that was a point to make as well. But then it goes to So the next scene takes us back to Terminus, where I kind of want to gauge how you feel about this too, but they're searching rubble and they find the commander kind of crawling and take him into custody. They make a real quick note that they say, oh, these jump ships are so advanced that they protect people on them, after kind of seeing it completely obliterate in the last episode.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I kind of like suspended disbelief for a second and was like, okay, well, maybe they have like some kind of force field tech that the Kleons would have in an instance like that, almost like an airbag or like a seatbelt kind of thing if that happened, or I don't know. But I thought it was weird that he was just crawling and was like, okay, for the most part.
That was my biggest gripe with the issue. That right there is my biggest gripe. And like the whole, like the throwaway conversation those two guys have was like, yeah, the Emperor ships are really good at protecting their people. Ha, yeah. Ha, 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 ha. Yeah. Oh, here's the random guy we need. Is the it only felt person.
Convenient. Yeah.
Yeah. That the only survivor is the one guy they need in a ship that like, there's like very few parts left of it intact. And you're going like, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It blew up, but you know.
Okay.
Right. I think at the very least to kind of sell that, if you want to sell that to us, that you have to show a bunch of these soldiers being shot. Like not just the commander by himself crawling away, but maybe like there's other guys that are kind of injured and on the ground and they're shooting them and kind of like killing them in that instance. And then they find the commander like, and go, oh, this is the guy we need. That would kind of be a little more palatable.
Yeah. Or they had prisoners, or they had someone like they're holding guns to their heads. Like,
right.
More than just the random one guy crawling with like next to no fatal injuries who hasn't realized there's a armada full of people around them, and he's like, oh, let me go get my gun with like 30 people here that didn't even notice that they just showed up out of nowhere.
Yeah. And do you have any theories as to why they specifically need him? Do you think, because I don't think he would carry some kind of hostage value necessarily. I think Kleon would just go like, let's cut our losses and kill all of, you know what I mean? I don't think he would hold like hostage value, so I'm not sure what they would really need him for.
It's revealed later on in the episode.
Oh, okay. So they do talk about why they specifically need him. I must have just missed that. We can talk about it when we get to it, I guess.
Yeah. They say why, and it's a really good reason why, because they explain like why they specifically they chose that planet, Terminus. Yeah,
Terminus. Yeah, and the Foundation.
Yeah, why they specifically targeted Terminus, the Foundation, and all that stuff. There's a few things when they do that I'm like, this is malarkey. This is pure malarkey.
Yeah, we'll get to it when it comes up. So it goes from that to, I think the next scene is the kids, right? So it's the kids in the firefight in the town. They move the kids in, or the one kid saves the other. I'm not going to know the names. I'm sorry, guys. I don't know any of these kids' names.
Yeah.
But the one kid saves the other kid, and they essentially take a hatch. Weirdly, they decide to go towards where everything. So they take a hatch into like the main area where the Anacreans are all clustered. I guess they're going to save somebody or something like that. But I got the just initially that they were just trying to get away from people shooting at them. But apparently they took a hatch right to where Salvor was.
Yeah, which is weird. Like there are certain things that like you kind of go like.
Yeah, you just kind of have to go, okay, like, I guess this is just to move the plot forward or something like that, but it didn't make too much sense. But then they, the one kid beats the crap out of the guard, like, goes overboard, which makes me think that there's going to be another time jump and that kid's going to be a prominent character at some point in the show, because they, like, I remember thinking, like, he doesn't just knock her out, like, he beats her, like, four times and then kicks her in the face and knocks her out. And I remember thinking, oh, this is setting up some kind of character that we may... see in the future.
Yeah. But then the kids they go and they rescue
Salvor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
The other thing too, when we talked about this last episode, is I was really hoping that there would be a valid reason why Salvor was kept alive. And I don't know how you felt about the reason that she gave was that Salvor seems to be a key to the vault or something, like she seems to be the only key to the vault. And I don't know how Farrah would know that. Like, I don't know how... I know that she drove next to the vault and passed out, but I don't know how Farrah knows that only Salvor is not affected by the vault, or that it wasn't some type of tech that she had on her that would have kept her clear from passing out from the vault or something like that. I wasn't sure how that...
They mentioned it in a previous episode, like, when she was really, really young, she was able to, like, go all the way up and touch the vault, so they never knew why she was that special.
They said that to Farrah Keen?
No, not Farrah Keen.
That's what I'm saying is I don't know how Farrah Keen would know that Salvor is special considering the vault.
I think Salvor is just a pain in her ass. And she's like, you know what? I'm just going to keep you close because you're such a massive pain in my ass. And if something goes wrong, I want to be the one that kills you.
I guess, yeah, I don't know. Like I think the smart move would have been a killer, but again, like if anybody is watching and they know in the comments why Farrakeen would have some kind of knowledge as to how Salvor is the key to the vault, I'd love to know, because it didn't really click with me when I first saw it. But anyway, Salvor escapes. They see Abbas and Hugo, I think, right, is the other character.
Yeah.
And they see them outside. Oh, and
before we get to there, that's we're missing the scene. Right after Farrah interrogates or talks about Salvor, and we see the kids go into the room.
Mm-hmm.
Farrah goes and talks to Salvor's mom and Lewis.
Right, right, okay.
And that's where she gets the list of all the passengers that have the specialties in like aeronautics, propulsions, and they mention the dude's name from the spaceship, because since he's a pilot, he will know how to fly it, because they're trying to resurrect the Invictus.
Okay, yeah. So, are you sure it was pilot? Because and that he had special knowledge of or something.
It's because he knows how to pilot deep space.
Okay, so he knows kind of how to use the jump drives and stuff like that.
Yeah,
okay.
He'll know how to pilot. He'll know how to like utilize the ship. Yeah.
So they get essentially dossiers on kind of specialists that were with the Foundation. I thought that was a good reason too. To be fair, like I remember thinking, oh, that makes sense why they would attack the Foundation, is because the Foundation, because of its scientific nature and stuff, they would have these people that are very specialized in these tasks that they would need to resurrect a dreadnought ship or whatever. We talk about the Invictus here. The Invictus, I guess, is something that we missed from the last scene too, because that's what Farrah says that they're trying to find and trying to repair. And apparently it's some kind of like mythical ghost dreadnought that got lost in space, and apparently she's found it, and now they're trying to figure out how to get it back online. But Salvor uses the word planet killer, so apparently this is a really big deal ship that could probably give the Empire a lot of headaches if it came back online. Probably give a lot of people a lot of headaches and stuff as well.
That was a fun thing, but yeah, that explains why they needed all those people, and it kind of helps. And I like the scene where they go over the stuff, because you kind of see them going like, okay, we have a dossier of who we need to figure out and who we need to get.
Right. Okay. And then the scene goes to outside. They meet Abbas and Hugo, and she says that she is pretty confident that Harry's speaking to her through these visions, and that she's going based on her instinct and her intuition at this point. And her intuition is telling her that she needs to destroy these Corvettes, which we saw in an earlier episode. They've landed next to, I think they said they're geothermal generators or something along those lines. So they're going to take the Corvettes out. So Hugo, Abbas, and Salvor head off in that direction, and they leave the kids there, which kind of brings up, well, it doesn't really bring up a point, but it answers a question I had later in the episode as well. So after they do that, they are, like you said, they're questioning Lewis and the girl about the team that they need, because they want to fix a jump ship. And it also makes sense as to why I said, if you want a jump ship, I remember in a previous episode, I said, if you want a jump ship, why would you destroy the one that came in? It's because apparently they found another one, a bigger, better one, and they just really need the expertise in how to fix it. So they didn't really need that jump ship to begin with. And it's probably a lot harder to commandeer one of those ships than to bring it down, to be fair. So we go from those scenes into our brother Day storyline. And I kind of want to know what your overall thoughts were kind of on this subplot in the episode.
I loved every aspect of the subplot. I think this one helps set up the cracks, helps set out everything that starts leading to the downfall. And it was perfectly done. It was beautifully done. It mirrors a lot of historical aspects and mirrors a lot of really great things. I just love it. I love it all. The colors are beautiful. The scenery stands out. The acting, it was very well-constructed, well-meaning scene.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's great about it. And when we get into the in detail breakdowns of the scenes, I really, really, there's a few that like really pop out.
Yeah.
And it gives out so much that it's really good. Like there's a lot of good scenes.
Yeah. And also she's featured in it, but I don't know her character's name. If you could find the girl, his love interest's name or whatever, while I'm going through it, just let me know. But yeah, he's talking to her and kind of, you can tell that he's kind of smitten with her, and
Azura, he tells her Adele or Azura. Odile. Odile. Azura, yeah, Odile.
Azura. I'll just say Azura. That works, yeah, for me. So Azura and him are speaking. He seems pretty smitten with her for the most part and seems kind of fixated on her. It goes from kind of their conversation where he's thanking her for giving him the medicine.
Yeah, the wolf's flower
or something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wolf's breath. I don't know. Let us know in the comments, I guess, guys.
Yeah.
But it then goes to Dawn hunting with Dusk, which I thought was was cool too. That's just such a rich dude move, is just to go like quail hunting or something, you know? It just kind of fits that. But I thought this scene was beautiful. I love the god rays coming through the trees. I thought it was photographed really, really well. We also get, this is kind of an important moment, at least as a sci-fi nerd in my eyes, which is we get our first like foundation alien, alien creature. It's, I don't know what they're called, but they're essentially like little birds.
Oh, that was gonna be my trivia question.
Oh, okay. For you. Yeah, don't tell me then. And then we'll do it during the end, I guess, and see if I will not know the answer. So.
Okay. I know the answer because cool. It's a good one. Yeah. But yeah.
So they go hunting and Dusk is, you know, bringing him along, and it's a weird, I can't ever get out of the headspace of like, when I see these scenes, I'm like, you're hunting with like a younger version of yourself, which is such a weird, like,
yeah,
it's such a weird interaction. But Dawn turns out to be much more adept at hunting than Dusk would think that he would be at that age, than he was specifically at that age.
Well, it gives it away. It's a camouflage bird.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really unique thing. And there's a couple of things I love about the bird and why they picked that particular thing. Cause you see like Brother Dusk, he's very keen. He knows like what to look for movement wise. And then you see Brother Day just kind of, he's like, wow, I've never seen Brother Dusk so happy. And then Brother Day's like, as a novice, like, oh, I got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you see Brother Dusk, like, even keel. And then Brother Day's like,
right. Okay. So that's interesting, because I didn't pick up that they were camouflage birds necessarily.
Yeah.
Like they were. When you say camouflage, do you mean like they go invisible, or do you just mean they have like a certain color that matches their environment?
They go almost invisible, and the only way you could tell that they're moving or where they're at is by movement. So you see like a kind of distortion to the field, and that's the creature. So they have a camouflage setting where they kind of mirror the environment.
I must have missed that nuance, but it might feed into a revelation about Brother Dawn later in the episode, which we'll get to when that comes up, I guess. But yeah, they're hunting. I don't remember. It's weird because anytime this kind of stuff comes up, I want to go through the whole subplot, but I'm pretty sure it's broken into stuff as well. But this whole scene was kind of showing that Dawn under his wing and is trying to teach him hunting. And Dawn, we find out that Dawn is a little more adept at hunting than Dusk was, which raises some questions as to like how is he more, they're supposed to be the same person. So it also kind of raises these questions as well.
And it's supposed to be like a very hard to hunt animal. So it's a really, when they explain it, all the clues are there. You kind of go like, crap, how come I didn't see it ahead of time?
Yeah. So we go from that scene to, I think the next scene we haven't discussed yet is back on the conclave, the maiden.
No,
yeah, the maiden conclave.
No, we're still on we go back to Terminus, because that's where Salvor creates the plan with Hugo and her boss, Abbas, to blow up the corvettes, because they are still stationed there. So if they're able to blow up the corvettes, it now limits the Anacreon's ability to get off planet and get to Invictus.
Yeah, and that's what we had discussed is that they want to go blow up the corvettes because they're located on some kind of geothermal plant, and that's when, like I said, Salvor says that Harry is speaking through her with visions and stuff like that.
Because that's where we get like the most important scene involving, or it leads up to the most important scene involving Salvor and all that stuff. But then it's a very brief scene, but that's where they set up like we need to go after the corvettes, and it shows that.
Yeah,
it's going to lead to something bigger.
Yeah, she thinks Harry is speaking through her. So that's kind of the information that we got.
And then we go to where you are correct, the maiden and
This is some kind of posh, hoity-toity, like dinner party for like all the high society luminists and stuff. Or better yet, maybe I'm completely misreading it, and it's more awake for the Proxima. But it just seems like a very like high society type dinner or drinking, you know, party or something along those lines. But Harry, Cleon is there. The Proxima, or not the Proxima, Zephyr Galotz, who is the one that he wants to become Proxima, and then Zephyr Halima, who is the heretic that doesn't believe he has a soul, is there as well. And the advisor there says, "Hey, we have a much more. We're sorry about the crappy reception you got. We have a much more warm reception here that should hopefully appease you." And then they go in, and he is trying to make a statement and trying to kind of throw his money and power behind Zephyr Galotz to hopefully boost her into becoming the new Proxima. And the scene, I thought, so essentially Zephyr Halima has been saying, making metaphors about water and about how the thirst for water and stuff to her people, and kind of using it as a religious metaphor. And he's saying, let's make the metaphor true. And he says that I'm going to create a desalination plant moon-wide, to where everyone on the Maiden will have clean drinking water, which is a pretty tall order that he gives them there. So they're thankful essentially, and you can see that he's trying to kind of undercut any support for Zephyr Halima. What did you think of the dinner party scene? Did anything kind of jump out at you there?
One, the major thing that jumped out to me on that dinner party scene is when we first meet the Zephyr Halima. It's she only has one container, and she view her, and to me, it's really unique because she has one container, and then Galat has two containers. And it made you realize, it made me feel that Halima viewed herself as an equal to the Emperor, where they're able to see her from the same chalice. And it's not for indulgence or anything like that. But you see that when they do these rituals, it's like a sip and that's it. So Halima is taking the approach of, I'm going to conserve water, I'm going to conserve resources. I view myself as an equal to the Emperor. And we'll share from the same cup. We see Zephyr Gallant, she has two cups, and her servant is holding it. And it harkens to the loyal, the wealthy not understanding the plights of the poor, the ones that are struggling, because she has a servant holding two cups of valuable resources. That's how little she, that's how little her views are on that resource, that she doesn't care about it because it's always been abundant for her.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't catch that, but it totally makes sense that because Galat kind of comes off like a tone-deaf person that's kind of disconnected from her people. They kind of view her maybe as inauthentic and not really empathetic to the plight of her people and of the poor there, or whatever they're going through. And that, yeah, that makes 100% sense now that you say it. If she's using the same chalice and saying, we should be drinking from the same chalice to conserve water, it's she's like walking the walk, you know what I mean? Whereas Galad is more of a talking the talk type person. So and that's kind of alluded to later in the speech, is her Halima's ability to kind of speak with the people on their level, and not like she's speaking down to them and stuff. So they kind of present her as a progressive revolutionary, which I think kind of lands as well. But that's a really good point. I didn't pick up on that.
And that scene, it helps set the stage for Halima's speech, where she pretty much dethrones the emperor. But it pretty much sets the stage because you see her face at the very end, going like, "Okay, asshole, it's on. It's game on. Like I want to work with you. You said hell no, and that's it. Hell is coming to you."
So it goes from that back. So we go back to Terminus now. They're walking on their way to find the Corvettes, and there's a kind of a character scene with Abbas and Salvor, kind of discussing some backstory. And what I took it as is kind of they're narratively and character justifying what occurs later in the episode to make it like not so stark and kind of out of nowhere. So Abbas essentially tells Salvor about his time as a kid on Terminus, and about the fact that he really just joined the foundation for the girl. So he did it for the girl. I did see some similarities with them kind of setting that up with kind of Ra's and Gale, where even later in the episode they talk about this kind of forbidden aspect of them, but that choosing the one you love over the more practical decision at that point seemed to be the way that a boss went. So I have a feeling that that kind of theme of choosing loved ones over logic may come back in the episode as a lesson that Salvor learns or something along those lines. But the scene felt odd to me. It felt kind of strangely placed, especially considering, like, I'm watching this and they're walking, kind of joking about their time on his time on Terminus and about how he followed for a girl. And I remember thinking, like, they're like a couple hours removed from like mass murder of their entire, yeah, like, you know what I mean? That's like mass murder of their entire settlement. And I remember thinking, like, I didn't feel the weight of like what happened, you know?
Yeah. And like what made it really, really stand out about like the weight of what happened, like you just mentioned, is when they're doing the selection of the people that they need, like the astrophysicist, whatever it is. They just so happen, oh yeah, they're alive. Everyone's alive that we need. Okay, cool, let's yeah, move yeah on. It's like, yeah, you guys blew up the damn town. There's like nobody in the streets. And just so
like
happens,
they didn't accidentally kill someone that they needed. Like, you'd think, yeah, maybe they did at some point, you know.
And there's 8 people, and out of those 8 people that you left alive, the 5 that you need are just yeah so happen to be there. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's more, you know, I always just go back to like that horrific thing happened. And in this episode, I think my one criticism of this episode is I didn't feel the character weight of like what just occurred. Like you yeah, you know, you've picked up the foundation and gone to Terminus and you're doing this like huge thing that you think is going to save the galaxy. And the Anacreons just came in and they just pretty much set fire to your whole settlement. And now your settlement's yeah hostage. And as these characters are walking, like, I don't feel the trauma of that. I don't feel like they are experiencing any kind of like real major loss. They're kind of reminiscing about Trantor and kind of, it's very yeah lighthearted.
And punching the wind.
It, yeah, the whole fist in the wind analogy that he uses later on as well. But yeah, that's kind of my one thing with that scene, was it didn't feel like it tonally fit with where we were in the story yeah or where we were in the episode.
Yeah, they could have cut it out and it wouldn't have added to it or taken it away. It would have been the same exact scene regardless. So it was an unneeded scene. I do agree with you.
I want to be careful with saying unneeded necessarily, because considering what they were going to do later in the episode, you had to have some kind of character closure specifically. It's just, it felt oddly planned. Like, it was like, I feel like maybe we should have had these moments with her and her father earlier in the season or something, where
yeah
it didn't feel like they were just kind of giving us this little character closure for what happens later, which we'll get to. So I mean I get why it had to be there. It's just, it felt tonally inconsistent with where yeah they would really, I feel like they would authentically be as characters in that point.
I think it could have happened in another episode, probably like mm-hmm the episode before, where they had like the downtime and you could kind of see like the connection that they were building. And
yeah,
since he was a previous warden, it could kind of been like, yeah, you know, I was this type of warden and you're this type of warden.
Yeah.
You're more cut off for this life, because me, I just fell for your mom. I chased her. Like, kind of set that up a 2 or 3 episodes beforehand.
The open your hand thing, like they could yeah have done that earlier in a previous interaction. And then it would have felt earned and kind of like, we've talked about this. I think that's one of our big criticisms with the show in general, is that the thread seems so short. Like,
yeah,
they'll set up a thread in the episode and then 2 scenes later, they'll pay it off. And it's like, there's not a longer vision for these characters specifically. It's very like, it's very short in how they set these up. But I'm just thinking, like, in the first couple episodes when she's talking to Salvor, he could have told her the story about keeping your fist closed and keeping your, you know, I think he yeah says, open your fist, Salvor, don't fight the wind, as kind of the line. And I think, like, had they had the foresight and put that into like an earlier interaction, it yeah would have had a much more emotional resonance when that happens later on. But it seems like they set stuff up and pay it off really quickly in this yeah as well. It goes from there to, I want to say, back to the hunting thing. So this is yes where we get that Dawn. So the information that I got from this scene is that Dawn knows that there's something different about himself, and he's trying very hard to hide that, for probably good reason, from, Brother Dusk and Brother Day. So,
yeah,
he sees that, his, you know, his assistant, who I think is going to become a little more prominent character, and I'll tell you about that in my predictions aspect later. But his little assistant character, it says, wow, you've killed 6. You've doubled Dusk's record on your yeah first attempt. And then Dawn immediately kind of gets like very scared and says, wait, how many did he kill? 3. And he throws the additional ones in there and says, I only killed yeah 3. Don't tell anyone that I killed 6. And it seems like he's trying to hide his it's kind of an empathetic, like, I kind of empathize with his character, because he has to constantly gauge where Dawn and Day are and mimic them as much as possible. And he can't be himself because if he's himself and they realize he's different, they're going to think something's going on with the cloning and that he's like a bad egg, you know? That's what I got from that scene is he's trying very desperately to hide his differences and deficiencies or proficiencies in this instance from Dusk.
Yeah, no, for sure. And this scene, it kind of hints towards stuff because this is the first time we get to see the bird in action, and we only got to see the bird from Brother Don's point of view, which was unique because we never seen it. We just saw them, pew, that was it. And then all of a sudden we get to see the bird. So you kind of go like, okay, that was kind of like, you could have not shown the bird. Why are you showing the bird? So that was a really unique thing. And then it leads to other stuff because now Brother Dusk is like, oh, hey, buddy, you're a man now. We went hunting. And you could tell that Brother Dusk has no idea how to interact with his younger self because he's like, he's so far removed of what who this Brother Don really is because he's like, okay, we'll go hunting. Then here's a drink. And then let's go to a whorehouse.
You're
like,
So does the whorehouse happen in this scene or does that happen later as well?
It happens.
Oh yeah, it has happened in this scene. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's and you know, when you brought up the camouflage thing, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess I should maybe save it for later. But essentially, just to skip forward a little bit, Brother Dawn diverges to Azura, girl. He says that she essentially finds out that he's colorblind and he says, yeah, I am colorblind. And the colorblind thing makes a lot of sense in retrospect. Cause you're like, if he's colorblind, then that camouflage is not as prominent as maybe it would be otherwise. So that may make sense why he's so good at shooting like six of these things down is because of he's seeing different colors where he's able to see the motion of these a lot more specifically than Dusk would. So that kind of adds to that I didn't pick up when I first watched it. But now that you say that they were kind of camouflaged animals, it's like, oh, well, if they're camouflaged, that makes a lot of sense as to why he would be more proficient at shooting them if he's colorblind, you know? So it goes from there to, they go to a whorehouse. And the conceit with this whorehouse, what makes it different is that at least what Brother Dust says makes it different is that Cleon the First set this up as like a whorehouse where like their memories are wiped every day or whenever they use the services, their memories of the last 24 hours are wiped clean so that they don't have to worry about potential state secrets or any kind of intergalactic business that they may be divulging. So it's essentially like a therapy. It's like sexual therapy. where you know, the Cleons go there, they get to have sex with a prostitute, divulge their entire like life story to these people and not have to worry about any of it coming out essentially or so Dusk alleges, which comes up later as well. But so he goes in to speak to one of the concubines, I guess, and he doesn't seem very interested, and it's mostly because what I got from it is that he's pining, he's got another girl in his mind, he's pining for Azura, and he's not really interested in those prostitutes.
Even the concubine he did pick looked very similar to Azura because it's the same length of hair, same facial features, similar body types.
And so he speaks to her. Brother Dusk essentially gives her him as like a reward for his hunting and becoming a man, I guess. But he's not into it. He just wants to talk. So he just wants to kind of use her to talk and stuff like that. So he's not really into that. But I do realize now that you say that she does look very similar to Azura as well, similar features. But it goes from there immediately to the scene where Brother Dusk is questioning her and he says, what did he, so obviously she's not, the memory's not wiped clean. Brother Dusk set that up so that he could try to get some intel on Dawn, and this goes back to the feeling that we had early on in the episode and in previous episodes where we saw some differences with Dawn, where Dusk is starting to suspect that Dawn may be like him as a younger person. It seems like there's a lot of differences that are manifesting with Dawn, and Dusk is pretty he's suspicious.
He noticed it. So then afterwards, I wholeheartedly agree with you. It's a very, now you see this disconnect between the Cleons, and this is like the first time you openly see it where he's like, hey, what's up?
He's outwardly suspicious. He's obviously, he has spies, and I say spies plural, and I'll get into that later, but he has at least a spy from that brothel working to kind of find some information about Dawn to figure out, you know, behind the scenes what's going on. So yeah. He asks her what she said and they cut it short. So obviously Dawn may have said some incriminating things and now Dusk knows that. So we have to keep that in mind as an audience as well. It goes into a firefight. I don't know how you felt about this specific, but this is a kind of big scene where this is a big scene overall because we get the vision in this one as well. Yep. So they find the Corvettes. They are heavily fortified with a bunch of Anacreons. So they're coming up with a game plan as to how to destroy these ships. Abbas says that he wants to go blow the ships up. And Salvor says, no, you're too old and fat. You can't do it. You're not able to. Yeah, you're not able to do it, so just stay here. Salvor goes down to try to do it on her own, and she gets hit with one of her visions that happens. Yep. So she kind of loses consciousness for a second, and we're all of a sudden transported back to, I can't remember the ship's name, but we're on the ship that essentially is taking them to Foundation couple episodes.
It starts with a D, the
Discovery something. Or something? Is it?
Yeah.
Is it Discovery? I don't know.
Yeah. Like
they transport her. She has a vision where she's transported back to that ship, and we essentially see the interaction right before Gale walks in between Harry and Raish that is ill-fated, and that's the one where Harry gets stabbed and dies. So we get to see the conversation that happens before that, where essentially, as I think we expected, I think as most people expected, this death was not out of nowhere. Harry kind of orchestrated his own death. Yep. And one of the interesting things that's revealed is that he orchestrates his death because he needs to die in this for something to happen mathematically with the ordinal analysis that he's been studying.
Yeah.
But more interestingly is he says that the fact of Raich and Gale being together is what causes the math to break down. So he says something along the lines of you can't be with her. If you're with her, this doesn't work. So yeah. their love or their relationship is detrimental to the work of the Foundation. So what I got from that is that he says, you have to kill me and then you have to get in a pod and go to this thing as a way to one, make Harry a martyr, which makes him his vision and his voice a lot more powerful in the long term. And then two, it also solves the problem of making sure Raish and Gale are separated because there's no way that the Foundation's going to keep Raish on if he kills Harry. Yeah. So it's this, I think it's a two-pronged sword of saying like, this is going to cover me becoming a martyr and it's going to be cover you staying away from Gale and not being connected with Gale any longer. And that's kind of what I got from that. What did you think of that scene with the flashback of Harry and Raish and everything?
That scene was, we knew what it was. We knew that it had to separate them because we talked about like how there's something that did not seem right between Harry, Raish and Gale, that they were setting up a conflict where it was, they said something and Raish corrected him right away. So it was already building that type of conflict right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
So it just reinforces that we were right about that there was a conflict that they were creating to show that there was separation between them and there was going to be issues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's always more to the story because looking back at the previous episode when Harry reincarnates on that ship and he sees Gale, it's not a look of shock or surprise. He's like, okay, cool, Gale's there. And you see him here saying to Raish, keep her away. Keep her as far away as possible. Don't implicate her. Don't get her involved.
Mm-hmm.
She's out. And it's everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. She shows up. Raish saves her instead. So now we know the ship was programmed to Raish. Now we know why it was programmed to Raish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of unique that like all this happened and who would be the one that would figure out how to get to where they were. So it did well to set up the previous, or like the ship and all that stuff, the reason why, but it's one of those things where it's like, it too convenient. Everything happened too conveniently that like Gale knew that counting the prime number, something was wrong. Raish, instead of running and letting Gale say Raish killed him, throws her in the pot instead. It's like, okay, well, we need some of the other reasons. We need some of the other stuff to help make this explain it. But I liked it. It did set up the reasons why, which was good.
Yeah, it kind of just reveals to us very expositionally, kind of exactly all the information that we need. That's if it would have been a little more ambiguous, I probably would have been a little happier. They were able to kind of leave a little more mystery, especially to it. But it sets up the stakes a little bit now because we're in uncharted territory. We're off of Harry's plan. We don't really like everything that happens from here on out isn't part of the math specifically, or it's. It may be connected, but it's not specifically the plan Harry was trying to execute. So we're it kind of sets up the stakes of like we don't know what's going to happen. Harry probably didn't understand what was going to happen. Maybe he did, but it seemed like he she, Gale throws a wrench, big wrench into his plans as well. So we get Salvor sees the vision, but she's now because she passed out. Hugo has to run to kind of help her because they're pinning down her location. So Abbas has to sacrifice himself by going to get some bombs and taking them to the corvette ships and de just deploying them, which kills him. His last thing that he says to her is, "Open your fist, Falvo. Don't fight the wind," which just means kind of like f let destiny happen. Don't try to force into a certain direction. Let kind of go. He's essentially telling her to go based on her intuition and instinct, like she's been doing for that as well. What do you think of a boss's death?
It's not that it's convenient. It's like he did die. It sucks, but like at the same time, how far away did he really get from those crates with all those bombs? Like, couldn't Salvor just shoot the box full of crates and like have the same type of effect? Like, why did he
I
have
thought that too, but I think he had to like carry them closer to actually affect the ships specifically or something. Like I could write that off in my head as just like, oh, they had to get the bombs closer to the ships in order for the ships to be destroyed specifically. I could kind of write that off. Again, like I think the scene was fine in my opinion. Like I thought the scene was good. I thought
Yeah.
I like that they closed with that quote from him of just kind of telling her and him sacrificing himself to save them. I think that all makes sense. The action was kind of hit or miss for me there. I didn't think it
Yeah.
was that exciting, and it was a lot of just kind of scope shooting, and it seemed fairly easy considering the rest of the show. And the again, I think my biggest problem with them is just like the short threads. I feel like it felt like, okay, we just had this moment with the boss about 2 minutes ago, and now he's sacrificed himself. It doesn't feel well. It
Because
doesn't seem very well constructed or well thought out as far as character wise.
and like what we mentioned beforehand, because I know we're running short on time a
Yeah.
little bit. That was the first time we heard the open your hand, don't fist, and then say it again. It's like, okay, we don't have the emotional connection to it because you just said it maybe like 20 minutes ago. Now you're saying it now. We're supposed to be
Like two
like,
minutes ago,
yeah,
yeah.
it's a lifelong philosophy that we've
Right,
seen
right.
in action. No, it's not Hakuna Matata where you
Yeah.
see Simba grow up. It's sort of like, open your fist. Don't fight the wind. You're like, okay, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, so we get the scene where Abbas dies. The corvettes are destroyed, so Salvor tells Hugo, "We have to get back to this other ship, your ship, because it's the last ship that can really leave the planet surface, and we need to make sure we get there before they do." We get the ledge scene because we're gonna kind of speed through these scenes just because we're running out of time here. But we're gonna
Yeah, we
we
gotta
get the
get to.
ledge scene with Don and Azura where they're outside, where he essentially divulges that he's colorblind. He it shows that they're establishing some trust between them because he
Yep,
gets rid
because
of
he.
his bracelet and throws it on the ground. And that explains and essentially she says, "If I was you, I would throw me off the ledge." So they're kind of showing a budding romance between those two and kind of budding trust there. I'll get into more with my predictions for that
Yeah,
later
I'll
as
save it for
well.
the prediction as well too.
Yeah. So that scene was cool. I thought that their interaction was great. The views obviously were really cool. It goes from that scene to we get a short little scene of the Shadow Master Obrecht, who is now rummaging through the forest and finds those three birds that the assistant threw out when Dawn told him to hide from dust that he killed six. Which I don't know what you got from that scene. I immediately got that assistant that works for Dawn is also a spy, and he is giving information to Shadow Master Obrecht about the fact that he killed six out there. I think that's the only way the Shadow Master would have found those just rummaging around the forest unless he knew exactly where to look, which makes me think that assistant is also spying on Brother Day. Is that what you got from that as well?
Yeah, I got that as well. And then why camouflage yourself? Like that was the whole thing, was like the camouflage. The lead scene was really cool. I like that one a lot. Shows the trust between Azor and Brother Dawn, and the fact that she brings up like the only way you could keep a secret is is for you to kill me. Like, mm-hmm. you're trusting me with this major, major secret. The only way to keep it is to kill me. So are you sure you're okay with this? And he's like, yeah. let us make out.
Yeah, let us make out.
Then next, afterwards, we get transported to Terminus. Salvor talks about like her father, her mom, the relationship. Hugo kind of comforts her, mm-hmm. saying like, oh, it needs to be get done, but now we got to think about the future. We got to get off this planet right now.
Right.
And then from there, we get to probably the best filmed, yeah. acted, scripted part of the episode. And do we want to say series so far?
It's up there. It's definitely up there. I think I really liked Cleon's berating the mathematician scene. I think that's probably my favorite still so far. But this was definitely up there. This really felt, again, and I wanted to get into this earlier as well, but this scene specifically, Bear McCreary's score, I thought was really, really well done in this scene and in the next scene after this as well. But I thought the way his score swelled toward the end and it kind of just built up this hype. And I thought do you know the actress that plays Zephyr Halima? Does it have her name on there? But I thought that whole thing was really, really well done. Her entire speech and everything.
It's Tina Miller.
Tina Miller. Okay, yeah. I thought she was fantastic in the episode, and I thought this scene was really great where she gives this speech. I thought some of the reaction shots with Edo and Cleon were really well done too, kind of building that tension between the characters. And she essentially, this is the Proxima's funeral, so everyone's watching at this point, and she gives this impassioned speech about impurity and about how the Proxima has taken a linear life and turned it into a circle, and it brings up the idea of rebirth and souls and all that kind of stuff. And she makes a very pointed attack at Cleon and says that even souls 400 years ago would not be considered pure today and all that kind of stuff as well. So she's obviously making shots at him as being a soulless leader that's not worthy of his power and stuff.
Yeah, because of death, rebirth, the cycle of life, and it shows that he cheated death, and the only person that could cheat death is God, and he is not God, he is man. So that's a really interesting take of like the going back to like the science versus religion aspect of it, where he views himself as God, but she views himself as an equal since he is a man. And it goes right back to me, the whole cup sequence where she had the one cup to share, and because she views him as a man, not as a God, he views himself as a God. So it was a very well constructed speech and very amazing delivery that everyone in the audience that were kind of like, yeah, we don't really care for you, or like kind of not interested in what she's saying, starts seeing that like, yeah, he is right. She is right. Yeah. So it's
she's planting that seed in her people of that he's maybe not as godly as they would think. That scene was really great. I think the whole episode was really good character introduction to her. She's one of the more interesting characters at this point, even after that first episode, in my opinion. And the conflict between them is probably one of the more interesting things of the show as of right now. The conflict between Cleon and Zephyr Halima and how that kind of is going to work out, it's probably one of the things I'm most looking forward to. The other big key information that I'll kick through here is when she does give that impassioned speech and they all give their salutes and they all start bowing, Eto Demerzel bows right next to Cleon, even though she knows Cleon's not about that. She bows anyway, which really calls into question what her priorities are. If she values faith more than the crown and the empire, it really kind of adds an element of tension to her character, because we don't really know what she's going to do. Because if she's willing to bow for her religion in front of Cleon, even though that speech was obviously an attack on him, you start to wonder like, okay, well, what are her priorities? What does she value Luminism more than she does the Empire? And it seems like the answer is yes, based on that scene, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, no, I agree. Cause like leading up to when she bows, you see her give him looks like, this is why I did not want to come.
Mm-hmm.
You are pitting me against my religion.
Right.
And my duty to you. And these are things I cannot be a part of. And especially when they start talking about the souls and the reincarnation, she's lived so many years as the android, so she's almost lived an eternal life, and she's seen him just reincarnate himself, not really living life because he's already lived this so many times before. So for me, it was a really good it showed that it her the internal battle is being felt, and she knows that this was going to happen. She knew mm-hmm. that she was going to have to be pitted against him.
So and she knew what decision she would make if that happened. And it seems like she made that decision in that moment. So it goes from there, probably the strongest scene, to another scene where Salvor and Hugo go to the ship, but Farrah's already there with her entire posse. They take them hostage. But Hugo makes the god tier move of, I'm just going to slave my ship over to Salvor so they can't kill her. So essentially their only way off of Terminus is now with a ship that only responds to Salvor Hardin's voice. And that way they can't kill her, and they're going to kill Hugo. And Salvor says he's the only one that knows how to fly the ship, which I found kind of odd, because I'm like, you're telling me there's no other pilots that would be able to know how to pilot that ship aside from Hugo. But I guess I just kind of wrote that off and said, all right, well, I guess you need Hugo alive. So it makes sense that she would say that or something along those lines. But
yeah,
this whole scene with them kind of getting off of, and this is the scene where we finally leave Terminus. Bear McCreary's score is another great scene here. When the ship is leaving the planet's surface, his score kind of swells and is really great there musically. And I think because of the score and the impact of the scene them leaving, it feels like we're not going to be on Terminus. I got the feeling that we're not going to be on Terminus probably for the rest of the season, because it felt like a watershed moment of like, we're leaving Terminus now. We're going off into uncharted territory. It felt very much like not a final, but we're not going to be on Terminus for a minute.
Yeah. And the reason why I think that's 100% true, because Salvor, with the closest person that Salvor was to her dad. She was closer to her dad than mm-hmm. she was with her mom. And I do believe that we're not going to see Terminus for a long, 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 long time. Yeah. Before we move on to opinions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
In the speech scene where they all bow, the only person that never bows is Cleon. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, I thought that was very, very, because he's looking around like no one's bowing to me. Like, this is the first time he's seen people bow, and it's not to him. It's to the maiden. It's to the Luminous.
Yeah,
it's to the Proxima, and he is so confused because he's not used to not being the center of attention. So that was a really cool.
Yeah, and it probably would have been a smarter move for him to bow. I don't know. I go back and forth, but if he would have bowed, it would have shown his allegiance to Luminism. But I think the thing that's going to propel Zephyr Halima into the Proxima chair or the Proxima title is going to be that interaction, because there's now this huge, like, all the people saw everyone bow except for Cleon. So Cleon obviously is not serving that Lord. And I feel like they're going to kind of reject him. And I think it's going to go poorly for him essentially there. But so that's how the episode ends, as we leave Terminus. I think that was the last shot, right? It's just the ship leaving. Yeah. The ship leaves Terminus and we're heading off into uncharted territory here. So, what we can do is go into our predictions, or also first, before we miss it too, I want to know the name of that bird too. So what was the name of the alien bird that we were introduced to in this one?
It's the Gale Raptors. It's G-H-I-L-L-I-E. Gale Raptors.
Gile Raptors.
Yeah, Gile Raptors.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, they do kind of, they have a raptor vibe to them. I can see that, especially because raptors are now identified to be birds. So it makes sense that they would do that. Okay, cool. What do you have any theories or predictions of where the story is going to be going forward?
Obviously we know that it's going to touch upon a lot about what happened on the Maiden and things like that. But I think something's going to happen between Azor and Brother Dawn. I have a feeling Brother Dusk is going to kill her off. So her life is short on these episodes. I do like her as a character, but they're going to view her as a threat. They're going to kill her off. They're going to try to see if they can circumvent his ascension to the throne by probably trying to exile him to somewhere else, to Brother Dawn, create a new Brother Dawn. And that's going to cause some issues, because everyone's going to like show the signs of imperfection, because we already know that Brother Dusk is prone to going overboard on his decisions.
Mm-hmm. It's very militant. And
this seems something like he would do, because he is the one that started all this stuff by bombing the Thespin and Anacreon. So I have a feeling that he's going to kill Azor. He's going to exile Dusk, and he's going to try to bring, or Dawn, and try to bring a new Dawn, and that's going to cause more conflict, and that will be the first war, because then we'll see the, we'll start seeing, like, a civil war of, like, who the Kleons really are. Like, if they could get rid of themselves, why should they be in charge? This is supposed to be tradition. This is supposed to be how it went, and then all of a sudden, there's a genetic defect. They're not perfect. There's something wrong. So I do see that being a bigger, playing bigger in the next few episodes.
And it seems like in regards to that specifically, with Brother Dawn or Brother Day, I'm sorry, leaving Trantor for the first time to go to this Lumina to talk about this Proxima, it can be seen as a show of support for Luminism, but it also can be seen as a show of weakness. Like, they're rattled or they're scared. They're all of a sudden changing their policies and protocols in this in this hour. And I think if anything does happen to Brother Dawn and something along those lines, it shows more cracks in that Imperial shield of consistency and power that has been lasting for 400 years. It shows kind of more degradation of that. And I can see people losing kind of faith in that if something were to happen along those lines. I have a different theory regarding Dusk, which is I think that Azura is another spy. So I think that Shadow Master Obrecht, who is tasked with finding her name to begin with, I think she's either doing it of her own volition and is kind of just working for potentially money or something along those lines, or I think maybe Shadow Master Obrecht has some kind of collateral on her and she's going to have to divulge any kind of truth or information that is coming from him. It kind of feels like she feels like a betrayal character where it's like he's going to fall in love with her and then she's going to kind of betray him. That's what I'm kind of getting from it. And it makes sense that if Shadow Master Obrecht, who they show the assistant, obviously gave information to him or else he wouldn't have gone and found those raptors. It would also make sense to me that he would plant Azura if he knew that Brother Dawn had interest in her. He would plant Azura to kind of get information and give it back to the... So I feel like I do think that they're either going to kill Brother Dawn or something is going to happen where the Dusk and Day find out that he's different and he's maybe deteriorate. He has more deficiencies. I think that it's going to be Azura that actually sells him out, because I think that's going to be the more dramatic scene there. Also, again, I think that the two kids are going to become prominent figures. I don't know if there's going to be another time jump, but I think those two kids are going to be prominent figures going forward in the show as well. We're also going to get to see the Invictus. I don't know if it's going to be next episode. I think we're probably going to get a heavy dose of Gail Dornick in next episode. And she, last time we saw her, she was going to Harry's world of Helicon, I think is the name. We're probably going to get a heavy dose of Gail and Helicon in the next episode. Potentially we may see the Invictus ship as they go there. We're probably going to see either Zephyr Halima raised to Proxima status, or she's either going to surge in the polls and cause more conflict depending on how fast they want to go. I think she's inevitably going to become the new Proxima. So it depends on how long that takes for the next episode as well. Go ahead.
One of my last theories, I think Savor is Raisha's daughter.
I think we talked about that earlier too. I think that's definitely a possibility, is that she's Raisha's. So you think that when you say she's Raisha's daughter, you think that Raish slept with the other woman that was pregnant on the ship, and you think that she's the child of them?
Yep. Because every single time they take out like the fertilized eggs and stuff like that, I honestly think that that's where she comes from. Like, she's either Gail and Raish's daughter from a fertilized egg, like she was a test tube baby.
Right.
But there is a connection to Raish. Like, there is a deep, deep connection to Raish, because the vision that she gets are deeply his. And it was unique that when they had like the flashback where she saw how Raish killed Harry, she was wearing the same exact swimsuit that Gail was wearing. So it would have been from Raish's perspective.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't pick up on the swimsuit thing, but that would make sense. Also, I think there's the little thing that was behind Harry's ear plays a factor in this too, where I don't know if that's specifically recording his memories or recording his insights or something along those lines, but it would make sense if Raish was meant to be seeing these visions and it was tied to his DNA specifically or something along those lines, and now because Salvor may be maybe his kin or his child, that maybe she's getting sections or segments of it that are meant for him, but he's dead now. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's a possibility. Like, I can totally see that happening as well. Yeah, I think that's going to play a factor. The little puck behind the ear thing is going to come back at some point as well. But yeah, that's pretty much it, man. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts or anything like that? I loved little Salvor's little flex with the crowns thing.
Yeah.
Where she's like crowns and she flips it and just kind of eyes her and stuff. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So far, this is probably my second favorite episode.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of great things about it. There's a lot of bad things about it. Overall, it presented the story very well. It answered a lot of the questions that we wanted answered.
Yeah.
It brought us a new environment that we got to play with. And I just think that overall, this was a really good episode. We'll follow up with her second episode, which will be the Mysteries and Martyrs. And I can't wait to see how that is.
As always, guys, we had a great time here. This was episode 7. Next week, we're going to be for episode 8, Mysteries and Martyrs, as Brian said. So make sure to tune in around the same time for that. If you guys are listening on the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, if you're listening on Apple, just do anything that kind of supports the show. So if you want to leave us a 5-star review, that would definitely help a lot. Share the podcast if you guys are having fun with it and know other Foundation fans as well. We should be posting this on YouTube here in the next day or so. So you guys may be watching on that as well. If that is the case, make sure to like and subscribe on the video and share that as well if you can. Do you have anything coming up as far as like any articles or anything you're writing that you want to promo?
Not at the moment. I'm actually taking it easy, just going back to my comic stuff. I had a very, very busy week of stuff.
Yeah.
You have a watch party coming up.
I do.
Close race from what I last time I checked between Nightmare on Elm Street and 28 Days Later.
Yeah, we got a really close race between Nightmare on Elm Street and 21 Days Later. If you guys want to watch that show with us live, we're going to be watching that Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're also going to be doing trivia during the stream as well. So if you guys are into kind of watching fun horror movies here close to Halloween, Monday at 8 p.m., go to youtube.com/thedistract and subscribe and like on that. But that's going to do it for us here, guys. What do we got? Enjoy and respect the peace.
Yep.
May the light never dim. And triple blessings to you all. This has been Discuss Foundation, episode 7. We will see you guys same time next week.
Take care.